Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL, with guest co-hosts.
MSLS.
Rusty Edge.
Can you imagine one guy with a rifle standing behind a wall as an army of, say, you know, 700,000 people on chariots charges at him? Well, I guess I'll start with the guy in the front. Not even a guy with a machine gun could hold off that army.
Yeah, that's true.
So this is Polycast, and we are joined here today with Douglas Smith.
Hey, pleased to make the encore appearance.
Makalua.
Still needing caffeine.
Michael Lucas-Smith.
Inventing something silly to say like the Mean Team.
The Mean Team.
Now bringing you the ugly side of Polycast.
Daniel Quick.
Back again.
And of course, me, QNL. This is episode 91.
After you launch a spaceship, yes, you can move your capital. And if you're going to lose your capital and lose your space race, it's a good idea. Rush by it.
Well, actually, the point in that thread that was interesting was that you can pre-build almost the entire palace, and then if you stop building it in one city and build it in another city, the hammers transfer.
Yeah.
What's with that?
But it's no better than building wealth, so it's not like it helps a lot.
No, but the thing is that you can move your palace immediately to any city you want.
Oh.
All you have to do is pre-build the palace anywhere, and then just leave it in the queue forever.
Maybe that helps people out when they're running like Terra, or you get Tokugawa start on Earth 18 Civ or something. Unless you just easily transfer the capital.
Yeah, that was a really interesting thing that I did not know about, and it doesn't make sense. What do you do? Put all the bricks that you've made onto the transports and...
I was going to say, it's like when you see them hauling off whole houses and it's that oversized load tractor.
Yeah, but it's the whole palace, you know.
Yes. All three lanes of the freeway, and then some.
In the Senate, we discussed...
Specialization is for insects.
Settler as a diplomatic tool.
Can you do a Mason rush?
And the ugly side of expansion.
Well, sometime you should put in a Rickroll. Randomly, in the middle.
And then we'll lose like half our listeners right there.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Well, let's cut straight to the chase. Specialization is for insects.
Okay, so I'll be back in an hour, and...
By I am. The dominant theory on these boards is to specialize everything, but specialization is weak. Weak in life, weak in the game. Production cities, commerce cities, science, great people cities are like a tripod stool. Lose one leg of the stool and your empire falls. A non-specialized city is like a dozen ballerinas with flaming machetes. Lose a few and it doesn't matter. You're still strong and dangerous. Specialization equals death. Then later he corrects the quote from Robert Heinlein, a human being should be able to change a diaper, plan an invasion, butcher a hog, con a ship, design a building, write a sonnet, balance counts, build a wall, set a bone, comfort the dying, take orders, give orders, cooperate, act alone, solve equations, analyze a new problem, pitch manure, program a computer, cook a tasty meal, fight efficiently, die gallantly. Specialization is for insects, which is, after all, the topic of the thread.
There is so much wrong with this thread. Well, not the thread itself, the initial premise. There is so much wrong with the initial premise. Let me just start by defending our insect world here. The largest empire in the world is a super colony of ants, and it is... ridiculously massive across multiple continents, far bigger than the human empire, adding us all up, even though we're not one empire. Specialization is strength. In fact, it's sort of the pinnacle of evolution. And if you want to go for an even larger empire than the ants, you just step back along the complexity chain to bacteria. We float along fleetingly without even realizing just how powerful the bacteria are on our planet. We are insignificant in comparison. And then, of course, you can go the meta approach to disagreeing with this whole thing, is that while the human may be following orders, giving orders, changing a diaper and solving an equation, they're still just being a human. That's very specialized. So forgetting the whole meta argument about how you deal with this kind of outside the game, inside the game, an individual city might become specialized, but your empire would not. It would be ridiculous to only have cities that cottage spam. You're never going to specialize, but you want to get the most out of your individual cells, which is sort of the whole idea about being efficient. I really, really disagree with IAM on this specialization is for insects thing.
I wasn't 100% sure he was doing this seriously. I mean, I don't know.
No, I really hope not, but it sort of seems like maybe he thought that the city spam approach is better. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you want a granary in pretty much every city, but after that, it's not as clear. Well, okay, probably a courthouse, too, after the early game. So there you have two buildings that are reasonably okay to build in every city.
They don't really like the specialization thing, but you only have to win one way. So I think it sort of defeats the overall premise of the game to say that you shouldn't specialize, because in the end, you have to win through one of the six methods.
Usually specialization will get you there faster. Even for something like culture, you would put your culture multipliers in your best two or maybe three cities, depending if you want to use artist bombs to get there. That's true for space with hammers and military for hammers too. You can't have every single city be hammers. Well, you can, but it's not as efficient as, say, having a couple cities that go for commerce and then use commerce multipliers to pay for your bills. The whole point of specialization is that you save an amount of hammers. You don't have to build everything everywhere, and you still get close to the same output many, many turns sooner in the game. And the higher level you go, the more important that becomes, because it's the only way you can keep up with the AI's tech pace, or other good players for that matter.
It's actually one of the interesting problems with society right now is that in civilization, you have all these multipliers for science and for commerce. And at any time, you can say, we're going to focus on saving money and building up the empire's savings by ignoring culture and science and espionage. We can just snap our fingers and change that. But you can't actually do that in real life. You can't suddenly convince everybody that they should be saving up money and not using credit cards everywhere.
Wow.
It's very, very difficult.
I was trying to think of a civilization in which they turned off all science and turned on all espionage, and I think that would be North Korea.
There's quite a few civilizations that have done that, yeah.
Throughout history.
Unfortunately, it usually leads to genocide of some sort.
Right.
Pol Pot comes to mind as the kind of even bigger example of that. Turn off all technological pursuits.
Fortunately, I don't think they were going for absolute reality in Civ, because otherwise we have some very questionable things going on.
Well, so game is a game of percentages and bonuses and that add up over time. So the more you can specialize down one particular path, the more you're going to get out of that particular path. So the goal as the player is to balance your specializations well, but still get the most out of them.
There's also an interesting transition point. You mentioned earlier in this recording that you shouldn't build only cottage cities, for example, and for most of the game that's true. But once you hit democracy and have universal suffrage and can run emancipation, you could just carpet your entire empire in cottages and subspecialize only for gold.
Yeah, that's weird.
Buy an army.
It is weird.
It's weird, but it's effective because you can get 100% gold multipliers much more quickly than you can get either 100% hammers or 100% science even.
Right, and you still got food and you get gold and you get hammers. You get everything.
Well, if you get Kremlin, it's one of the most efficient production setups in the game, but even without it, it's not too bad. Brushby converts gold 3-1 to hammers, so you get like 7 or 8 commerce and then a hammer from Universal Suffrage and having a town. And you're already starting to look better than like a workshop under state property, unless you're also in caste, and you have better multipliers. So for a decent chunk of the game, that's going to be your best option, assuming you have the tile improvements to make use of it. Could also go that route with whipping, just farm everything, use Kremlin, get a discount on the whips, or late game, just convert everything to workshops to get a bunch of production. Say you don't need tech anymore, you just want to spam units and kill somebody, or spam space parts, or whatever. But for most of the game that matters, most of the game where the outcome is still in doubt, the multipliers and specialization are more important.
And of course, you wouldn't just have machine guns sitting in your city as a warrior wandered around pillaging all the improvements.
No.
And it's not like you don't have somebody two cities over who couldn't come and stomp on the warrior.
Yeah. And besides, once you get to those later texts with emancipation, if somebody did stomp on your cottage and you rebuild that cottage, it'll come back really fast at 100% growth.
Yeah, 35 turns.
It is a loss, but it's not a totally, utterly crippling loss. Unless, of course, you really didn't have any units and you weren't able to, for whatever reason, build a unit to destroy this warrior.
Well then, I'd like to highlight a couple of choice posts out of this thread. Number 12. Quoting I Am, saying the industrial era has turned man into an automaton. Dr. Null responds, saying, this is clearly false information. It is the future era, and only with the Next War mod pack that lets you turn man into an automaton. Post number 38, Mercury 529 says, he has a point. Specialization is terrible. This thread is one such example. He devoted an entire thread to this topic. If we all ignore the specialization of this thread, it would have been a lot more valuable.
This is true. This is such a generalized thread.
I should have read further down on this because somebody else picked up on the ants rule the earth kind of thing here as well. Someone says, the majority of inhabitants on planet Earth have six legs. Specialization obviously has something going for it. And someone else replied, actually, the main team, the weight of all the ants in the world is greater than all of humans. Roar. I don't know why you put the roar there. But...
roar? Because you're an ant? Oh, God. That's why we can't have the video podcast and you're going
to
be naked.
I actually look like an ant, too. It's all good.
If you are not specializing, if you're just going down one particular path, perhaps that will help you in the short term, but in the long term, being able to compensate for something drastic happening, you're really limiting yourself in that respect. If you put all your eggs in one basket, and then something happens to that basket, uh-oh, but if you've got your eggs in multiple baskets, if something happens to one of those baskets, then you could be allocating some pieces from the other baskets to place that basket. So if you lose your production city, for instance, or one of your production cities, then you probably have more than that one production city that can work to compensate for that. Or if really necessary, I forget what technologies you need, but there is the option to switch all of your X production into Y, like switch all of your hammer production into gold or switch it all into science, if you need to temporarily in order to help compensate for that.
Alphabet and currency for research and wealth. Music for culture.
I just capture another enemy capital or neighboring capital when I want another production city. That's my solution. But anyway, one more post. Number 47. Saracen has in his SIG line a fictitious quote from I Am. If you are not losing any cities in a surprise attack, then ask yourself, what am I doing wrong?
I'm really confused by this quote.
Because he mentioned, well, the specialization is wrong because if you have 12 cities and you lose 3 of them in a surprise attack and they're specialized, you're up the creek.
It's pretty much like referring back to post number 2, where Dave MCW quotes the several cities declaring you lose 3 of 12 cities, and Dave's like, that pretty much sums up the building spam strategy.
Yeah.
Because you're putting all those hammers into buildings and not units.
Let's look at this thread from a different angle, right? What if he's proposing a different playing style as a challenge? So you can't build any building that's unique. No wonders. No unique units. You must have one of every unit. At least, before you can build another of the same unit. It'd make the game really hard.
It sounds like a Rolo game.
Yeah. It can't be any harder than playing without building anywhere or using workers.
Well, you can build a worker, but before you can build another worker, you have to build a settler and a warrior and a scout.
It'd probably be pretty easy on Noble. I wouldn't want to try things too much higher than that.
He just doesn't seem really specific about his generalized strategy. Each city is its own Swiss Army knife, says Post 49. Mines, water mills, cottages, library, barracks, etc. I don't know. I just don't really see the merit of building a library or barracks in every city.
I think if the game mechanics were different, say the demographics of the population mattered. So every time you pick over the turn, the population cycles through and a percentage of the people born into that world now live with different demographics to the people who already lived in the world. As time goes on, people will become accustomed to certain things like education. So if you don't have a library in a city, people are going to not want to live there as much as in some of your other cities. But in reality, when you play at the higher levels in this game, you don't have the time. There's no real advantage to building a library in every single city or a barracks in every single city. There's just no point.
Yeah, it's blown hammers that you could have put towards something that helps you, even if it's just building wealth or research if you don't need units.
Yep.
Especially in the earlier game when it's all percentage-based as opposed to absolute numbers.
And your absolute numbers aren't that high, so percentage multiplier isn't that big of a deal.
It'd be like in the real world where you go and settle a town next to a hill that contains uranium so you can mine the uranium. But, oh, we shouldn't specialize on uranium. So, and this is an arid region. Let's set up some farms.
Now that I think about it, if each city has its own Swiss Army knife, you know, Swiss Army knives kind of suck. You don't really get that much done with a Swiss Army knife.
You'd much rather have an assault rifle, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I use to cook my food.
Yeah.
You just shoot it until it's cooked. You know, this doesn't get talked about enough, so Settler as a diplomatic tool. This is one of the funniest things you can do in the game. Let's face it, every time I pull this particular strategy off, I giggle like a schoolgirl. In the first post, in several of my games, I noticed that the AI can become a real pain. No joke there. All very happy. Yeah, well, and then they'll flip on you for no good reason with border issues. Negative 1 or negative 2 doesn't seem much, but sometimes, especially after a free religion flip, it can become a problem. I wonder if this would work. Build a settler, plant a city, oh, I'm just going to skip these directions, near the AI. Have the city generate science or units, zero infrastructure investment, until the other civ's culture starts pushing, and gift that city away. You get a +4 diplomatic bonus, or is it +5, by liberating a city to an AI. If an AI doesn't like you for whatever reason, you can cure it just by planting a city next to them. The problem with this strategy is that after a while, you run out of space. That's the biggest flaw, is that there's just nowhere to put a city to give away to the AI. But apart from that, I love doing this. It is so funny. It's such a hack. Here is a crappy city in the tundra, which has no production or anything. Would you like it?
Yeah.
Yes! I would! Give it to me!
There's a liberation element to it and a fair trade element to it. Liberation, basically for every 2 cities, you get 3 diplo, like Tachin says, like on post 2. But if you gift them a city early in the game, it is an instant +4. Our trade relations have been fair and forthright. So if you want to open borders with Tokugawa, that's often going to be the only way you're possibly going to be able to do it, because he won't open borders that cautious. I actually did this in one of my YouTube Let's Plays. I believe it was Lincoln, where I sent an early settler up there to get somebody to please so that there would be wars between other people. Because I was just culture-whoring that game up. But this is a very effective tactic if you want to steer who declares on who early in the game, too, because the AI will favor targets that are on its borders. So if you wedge a settler in between 2 AI saves early, plant, and then gift it to one of them, they're going to have a border now, too. Not only are they going to have culture pressure trouble between each other and get some negative demerits, you're going to get a diplo bonus towards you, so they're less likely to declare on you. And now they're starting to evaluate the other neighbor as a higher war target as well. So, yeah, in the right places, it can be a very, very powerful tactic.
It depends on what era this is occurring in, because you have to have this plan way in advance. Because I'm just thinking about the whole culture pressure thing. Depends on the size map you're playing, of course, but if the guy's culture is pressing on you, I don't know how much culture there would there need to be in the city for it to be considered a liberation.
Not much.
Yeah, sometimes you don't need any. You can just plant it on their borders.
If the city has expanded to have access to that tile, but they haven't invested any culture into it, or very little at all, they'll still consider it a liberation for some reason.
I've gotten liberations with 0 tile culture of the AI in the city tile, but the borders are overlapping, so I don't know what quite counts as a liberation.
There was another part of this thread that I thought was interesting, a misconception about the whole our borders cause tension thing. That's actually caused by your culture pressing into their borders, not by your borders just touching. That was worth revealing for some people as well, I thought.
Yeah, that's true.
And actually, it works both ways.
That's what they use for their land target considerations for picking war targets. But
so it's the same thing with people, really.
For the close borders demerit, it's based on culture going into each other's tiles.
If I have the Mian team next to me, sure as shit, I'm going to start getting angry with his culture push.
Hey, I'm not the one that usually pulls this crap. Usually.
Usually, huh?
You also have to keep in mind, depends on how you set up your game, because if you already have some sort of fair trade bonus, then the marginal gain that you get from that is greatly reduced. You can only get up to 4 fair trade, and for those of you who are unaware, fair trade actually means really unfair trade that you give to the AI. Like, trading a tech for their giving 100 gold, for example, is drastically unfair, and most of the time you will just do that for the diplo bonus, up to 4 for fair trade, which really means trade that is skewed in favor of the AI. Usually on the screen, it will say something like, our trade relations have been fair and forthright, which is pretty euphemistic, but whatever.
They won't necessarily take a city if it has no connection to them at all.
Yeah, it has to be at least somewhat close to them.
If it is in any way, shape, or form close to them, they'll gobble it up.
Yeah.
The situation that Michael was talking about at the beginning there, you were talking about the giggling like a schoolgirl.
No, first Phil's an aunt, and now Michael's a schoolgirl? Like, what the heck is going on in this podcast? I don't understand.
Well, I don't know. Michael said he's giggling like a schoolgirl. He didn't actually say he became a schoolgirl.
And I didn't say I was physically an aunt, just that I looked like one. Jeez, Lisa, I mean, you're putting words in other people's mouths and making all kinds of flagrant accusations. I don't know.
Phil just likes to wear the antagonizer costume.
Yeah.
I just like jumping to the island of conclusions.
It's along the same lines there, Phil. Post number 20, perhaps, you'd get a giggle from Michael along with a bit of a reverb, gifting a city, but then what actually ends up happening to that city. Something that would have to be done earlier on because of the prevalence of barbarians.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite tactics. Because there's no units in the city if you gift it. So sometimes, like, if I see, like, a barb archer or something, I'll settle the city and gift it to the eye and let the barbarians instantly raise it. So you get all the benefits and they still don't have a city.
No, totally. Otherwise you just lose a settler.
Yeah.
Why not get something out of it?
Yeah, that seems like a good return on investment.
Well, no, I do it deliberately. When I build that settler, I'm doing it to give it to the AI for the diplo bonus. But if I can get that diplo bonus for liberating a city without actually giving them a city, that could be fun. So if there's like some tundra area they won't settle.
Now the real challenge is to pull this off against a person. Can you trick another human being into accepting a crappy city on the verge of being captured by a barbarian? It's not like they would know, right? They don't know there's a barbarian archer standing on the other side of it when you offer it to them.
I mean, it would be kind of funny. I don't see how it would hurt the other human, though, because it's like nothing happened to them. They didn't spend any units or anything.
Well, if there's a turn timer, they could just wait and see what happens as well.
They could trade it to somebody else, and the city just keeps changing hands.
Of course, when it's against other human players, you can go in-game and see what your status is in terms of relation to the other human, but how the game calculates that might not be how the human calculates that.
Yes.
Like, they might think, oh, very funny, but it's not like, oh, I got +4, I got +5 instantly for liberating a city, or even...
What if you traded something for it? They liberate you a city and you give them a whole bunch of gold.
Yeah, Dan, sorry, if you're a heathen and I'm annoyed at you, I'm just going to declare, I'm sorry.
Not only to, quote-unquote, trick a human player, but actually then to have them have the same disposition towards you as the AI would. Now there's...
It can be very useful if they're friendly.
So the person who started this topic, Terracite, asking whether it's possible to have an early Maceman rush, he was really wondering whether we can just get them earlier in the game and what are some strategies for doing so. As for myself, I really like having Maceman early. Unless I have some sort of awesome, unique unit, usually I'll go for the Maceman kind of early because of the 8 strength, basically. And you know, usually when I decide to get Maceman early, I'll go, really depends on the game, but generally I'll try to get engineering first so I can have the crossbowman as a middle. The trouble with this is getting the civil service. And I think some people in the thread pointed out, oh yeah, you should Oracle civil service. I've yet to do that myself. I don't know if any of you guys have. Usually I'll try to get one of the prerequisite techs to civil service with a great person, get there faster. But other than that, I think that having an early Mason is actually pretty awesome. Some of the people in this thread were asking, you know, what's so great about that?
I think that's a legitimate question, depending on what you're trying to do with your maces. You're not going to get good returns on maces unless you have siege, even against archers. I mean, you attack like a city garrison archer or like behind a wall or something, you're going to lose a lot of maces, and that's a huge hammer cost disparity. So getting there ultra-fast isn't that great unless you get siege, too. But if you have siege, then even your catapults will just destroy classical defenders until they get longbows. So getting maces early isn't nearly as important as establishing a production base.
Well, spamming out horse archers to fight off the archers is going to work a lot better than spamming out macemen.
Yeah, same thing with catapults, and God forbid if you have elephants, because you can get those a lot sooner than maces.
Yeah, I actually haven't done an elephant rush in a while, and I think it's just not that appropriate at the higher levels, but it's still...
I can't pull it off at deity. I can do it on any other level.
Yeah. At the lower levels, it's very funny.
Accompanying the macemen with siege has already been mentioned. If I already have a considerable army of swordsmen or even perhaps lesser axemen, I might consider upgrading a few of those onto macemen and continue to invest in macemen if I don't have horse. But if I do have horse, then the ability to produce those units, and once I've got knights and if I've got the barracks and the stable, double promotion right out of the bat, not having to have any combat whatsoever, still accompanied with some catapults to assist, depending upon the strength of the defenders and the number of defenders, and some of those cities are on bloody hills, finding that they're just a better investment in the long run because I can see myself, okay, down that line, eventually down to cavalry. I mean, macemen will eventually go to either the grenadiers or the riflemen, and I know people have talked in the past about how powerful riflemen can be on the attack, but for me, they end up just staying at home in terms of defense, so definitely I can think of, you know, they've talked about the axe rush, certainly we've talked about that before, just bringing some catapults along, especially like City Raider, but have them accompanied by knights, just that extra in addition, go from 8 base strength from macemen, 10 with knights, it's just something that I would prefer. It could certainly be helpful to have maces behind in some of the border cities and upgrade those in key moments when it looks like, oh, you know, my axe or swords, I might not be able to survive that. That's good on kind of the proactive defense, like not actually having them be attacked, but to attack themselves if someone is coming in. And they could certainly be useful for once you've captured a city, like with my knights, for example, and catapult combination, to move in, and then they could hold that city so that my knights can continue on to the front because of also the speed consideration.
Strictly speaking, maces are a little bit better city attacking if you take City Raider than knights. If you bombard defenses, that is, because the way combat works, higher defensive bonuses, combats are looking better than City Raider. But in that era, you're going to be bombarding defenses or otherwise taking them down, or you're going to be losing units right and left to walls and castles. Medieval war is usually not favored in this game, for high levels anyway, because it takes too long. And the AI production advantage is pretty big in that era, and it's hard on the attacker. But if you're going up against somebody who tends to tech poorly but spams units and is aggressive, like Montezuma or Shaka or Tokugawa, those kind of guys, they sometimes get maces pretty slowly because they can't get to both civil service and machinery before 500 AD or so. In that case, if they attack you, they'll have their aggressive troops or whatever, but if they're an error behind, you can kill pretty much everything they have at 90% odds or better and really, really take them down a notch. In that case, maces can be very useful, and then if they don't have machinery, they don't have engineering, so you might actually be able to make some headway in a war like that. It's a little counterintuitive, but taking on those guys sooner can actually be easier if you can get even a small window from your maces.
I thought it would be worthwhile pointing out what Paradigm Shifter says here, that he was able to get civil service by 1000 BC. It was actually 96 BC, 51 turns in the game, yeah, civil service. Yes, that's a great achievement, and I love doing that sort of stuff myself, but you haven't got macemen.
Yeah.
You still need machinery. Somebody up the top pointed out it's very weird to kind of associate macemen with the word rush because you can't get them early. There is no super awesome technique for getting macemen so early that you're going to beat out everybody and be able to rush with them.
Yeah.
Horse archers, on the other hand.
Jeez, yeah, horse archers are one of my favorite rush units. I mean, especially below Immortal, you can just sweep a continent using them alone. It's crazy.
I like macemen also because of the techs that you need to get macemen are also just really useful in other areas.
Well, civil service is anyway.
And I probably shouldn't love it so much, but I do. I just like being able to irrigate my farms. What can I say?
No, it's a good tech. It's a priority early tech. But what isn't is machinery. That's usually gotten from the AI in trade.
Windmills!
Unless you're really into the mills, yeah.
I love windmills.
Windmills suck until replaceable parts. Maybe Riverside Financial windmills are okay in a special case. But seriously, windmills are a crappy improvement until replaceable parts. They're not worth going out of your way to research a tech that the AI consistently researches early just to get them. You can wait your extra 15 to 20 turns and trade for machinery for your windmills.
And you the la 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 was coming.
Who's the schoolgirl?
Well, we've been through this argument multiple times, MLS and I.
Oh, Phil's right, but that's besides the point. Windmills look cool.
Well, I'm not going to debate that. They certainly do. I have no argument with that point. This thread is started by K.O. Farrow. He's running into trouble while expanding on noble difficulty. As he's building more cities, his science lighter's dropping down from 100% to 60% to 30%. And he's considering that he's in trouble because of that. I picked this topic not because of the initial post, but just to highlight some of the important aspects of early expansion, especially if you're still getting used to playing this game or you want to play it at a high level. The first thing to point out is that your science slider, and people say this in the thread, the percentage on your science is not relevant so much as your actual beakers per turn is relevant. And fortunately, in Beyond the Sword, you can actually see your beakers per turn, though that's not as much of an issue as it used to be. You can expand pretty much infinitely using nothing but cottages, just pottery and monarchy, and growing out of the cottages. You could take up 3/4 of the map and win domination just doing that and still not go into strike. What's important is to get the multipliers for that later, but really what you want to do early in the game is get the tile improvements going. So expansion is critical, and dropping to 30% is not a bad thing. I mean, I don't know what you guys use as a rule of thumb for this, but for me, as far as I'm concerned, if I can get pottery and writing, I am willing to expand a 0% slider if need be to fill in the land.
I agree. There is a difference to what this guy says somewhere in the thread here. He says 1.5 works per city. When I am expanding like that, exponentially spitting out settlers to expand like crazy until I get down to 0% and have a stable GPT, I need 2.5 workers per city. Otherwise, I cannot keep up the economy fast enough to get the cottages up.
Yeah, I think I usually wind up around 2 initially, and then as I settle more cities and the initial ones have their enough tile improvements done and I'm nearing happy and health caps, then it tapers off. Like, I just stop building workers as they expand because they're keeping up. But yeah, at first it is 2, and if it's jungle, 2.5.
There's another sort of side to this story as well. If you spam out the cities like crazy and don't defend them at all and protect yourself from barbarians, and that's it, at some point the AI will declare war on you. And those cities that are out on the edge, you don't care about them. There is absolutely no loss in those cities whatsoever. You already have redundant resources everywhere. You already have your inner cities, which are superpowers now. And you can spam out a military to go and capture those cities back with ease. The difference is that usually you're so attached to cities that one city loss makes you feel like you failed. But when you've spammed out this massive empire, you haven't built any improvements, you haven't invested in anything, these are crappy size 2 or 3 cities on your border and you've got heaps of them, losing 1 or 2 in the initial few turns of a war means nothing to you. So it is a very different strategy. And the hardest part about this strategy is dealing with the barbarians.
How many cities would you have to have before you have heaps of them?
You know, if this is early game, if you get to like 10 cities in early game expansion,
I would say 15 or 20.
Well, I usually run out of room.
Yeah, that's usually the big issue.
Wow.
That's the problem.
What's the map size? You on an island? Are you on a continent? Who else is there? Like those kind of things.
Yeah, it depends.
So when you run out of room, that's when I start building up the military and defend the cities, basically. And I'll start building buildings in the cities. You know, that's a really big difference between, I would say, Prince and above, is this kind of need to build all these buildings and defend everything. That is a big stepping stone.
Yeah.
And also kind of what this guy says, he's like, he's scared when his tech gets down to 60%. That's another sort of stepping stone there as well.
Yeah, definitely. That's a lesson you have to learn quickly as you learn to expand adequately. Your science slider is going to fall. I mean, sometimes you'll run it at 0%. for half the game if you're going heavy on military, and you can win that way.
Right, and if you need to, you can just use science specialists.
Yeah, although there is a trade-off there with the commerce output, and it's very real if you're near 0% in striking. Sometimes you can't run the scientists because that pulls off cottage turns, and you need the cottage turns so you don't strike, which is interesting.
Right.
But, you know, as long as you get enough land, you're going to have resources to grow. You'll probably be able to trade for more resources and grow bigger, and then you can get to more important techs that let you stabilize things.
Right, and when you get to currency with all those cities, suddenly the trade routes pretty much pay for the entire empire.
Yeah.
So then you've got this massive commerce output that you can put into your science or anything else you want, really. You don't have to put in the science.
Yeah, a big learning curve for players is understanding where their empire's development is actually coming from, because a lot of people think it is the buildings, whereas usually they're tile improvements.
Well, this is actually, I think, a flaw in the game in many respects, is that those tile improvements are significantly more important than anything else you do in the entire game.
Yeah.
It feels like if you put the same amount of hammers and time into buildings as you do tile improvements, you should reap roughly the same reward, but you don't.
No, it's not even close.
Balancing a game like that is super hard, so I'm not that surprised.
Oh, then there's the whole defending it aspect as well. So that's a curveball.
I just love that post number 21 in the thread that goes by ZX0ZX. Wow, you have hardly any cities. Here's what you do. Tech pottery and bronze working. They are both super duper techs that you need. Next step, build like 10 axes while chopping and whipping. Can you guess what you do next? Kill your neighbor! And then he goes on.
I recommend chariots personally, but if you have copper and not a horse, go with the axes.
When Phil said that he's willing to do the expansion thing as long as he has pottery and writing, of course, he's saying that's because if you have pottery, of course you get cottages, you have writing, you get libraries.
Oh, yes, for some of our listeners out there who may not have made that connection.
Usually scientists will be more so for great person points than for base research, although you might be able to wheeze your way to like Alphabet or something or another trading tech using scientists alone if you're really desperate. At higher levels, that's a big consideration, is to get back into the trading game one way or another. And one thing you can do is like research aesthetics and then trade that for Alphabet and ironworking, possibly mathematics as well, and then try to get to either Coda Laws or Drama and Bulb Philosophy. And you'd be amazed how many early game texts you can get just doing that. On Noble, you'll probably need to self-research a lot of those texts instead because the AI is slower. But by the same token, your maintenance isn't nearly as big of an issue then. So it just varies a little in difficulty what you want to do.
And I know it's been addressed on several episodes before why you go for those particular technologies, but that's because those are the techs that the AI typically does not go for.
Yeah. Once you have the ability to trade, and assuming the AI is willing to do so, you're going to be wanting to research things that the AI doesn't have or doesn't tend to research, just because you get more out of that. And as nice as library sounds, 25% extra science in one city, if you research a tech and you're able to trade it for an equal value tech, that's 100% research in all cities in terms of speaker value. It's easily one of your greatest sources of research is just trades, and doing that well can make a big difference.
And you can reap the diplomatic advantages from it later as well.
Yes, which can sometimes be equally critical, getting AIs to declare on people that aren't you rather than you.
I guess you could use this whole expansion strategy in conjunction with using Subler as a diplomatic tool if you really want to expand that bad. You are, you know, overexpanding, and then you just kind of stop at like 10 or 15 cities and you just cannot expand further. If one of those cities is really close to the AI, then feel free to just give it away as a diplomatic tool, especially if you're at cautious or below and you don't have a great diplomatic relationship with the other civ yet. As Phil said, if I were that guy, I wouldn't be worried so much about the percentage of your economy that you're putting into research. Another thing you should also take into consideration is that when you're doing the overexpansion thing, if you're doing binary teching, you can minimize this problem. You can set your slider to zero while you have crappy cities and no libraries, build your libraries and time them so that they all get finished around the same turn, and then turn your slider back up to 100 to maximize the amount of research that you get. And as Phil said, choice of the right text is important.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
I don't understand, man. Makalu is a woman, too. She just has a less pitchy voice.
Should I say something or should I not say something?
Safer to not say anything, Dan.
I was going to have something to do with sultry, but you know, I'm just going to forget it. We're going to move on.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, still safer not to say anything.
No, I said something without saying something, so it's win-win for everybody.
I'm happily married, and I recommend that you say yes, dear.
See, you guessed it. You just hit the woman perfectly.
Aw, now you guys are a married couple. First ever wedding on Polycast.
Yes, do you take this man or do you take this woman in Good Games or Bad?
Women have won a domination victory.
And everybody's happy.
In a cultural victory.
It's not as fun.
You have been listening to episode 91 of Polycast. Today we had myself, Michael Luke Smith, and another guest, Douglas Rusty Edge Smith.
Yes.
As well as ye olde regulars, Makalua.
Can you hear me now?
Lisa Bang.
Yes, dang it.
Philip Bellew.
Peace out, Civ Scouts.
And Daniel Crick.
Are you playing Civ yet?
I had a giant stack of chariots that I conquered almost my entire continent with, and I was coming down to the very last few cities of the last Civ, and he just got rifling. Yes, I was using chariots at that point in the game. And I had maybe about 70 chariots at this point, and he had a few rifles in the city, and I threw all 70 chariots at the city, and the very last chariot won the city.
Really?
Yeah, I thought that I would win it much easier than that.
You normally would. Were they, like, protective or something?
I can't remember what his defensive bonuses were, but that's one of the things about this game, is that, yeah, it's random, it's got odds, but it seems that those odds don't really say what they say.
God, don't you really hate when you see the diplo screen and you're playing with humans and they'll say that the human is feeling something when they are definitely not? Like, Lisa is pleased with you. No, I'm not. I'm very annoyed.
Lisa is not amused. Oh, shit, I clicked on something by accident. Oh, man, I swore on air. My bad. I get band hammered.
Okay.
Yeah, I accidentally swore earlier.
There we go. How's that?
No, it's terrible. I can hear you again.
Okay, I think we've addressed that adequately.
I don't think we actually addressed anything.
Well, it's a good thing your opinion doesn't matter. So.
Do not click on. Save yourself. I almost got trapped in it again when I looked through that topic.
Did you get Rickrolled?
It's like pretty cool that it's consistently consistent. I don't know.
consistently.
Oh, whatever.
Oh, this is the thread where they're asking me about my avatar. Actually, it's not the only one, but I'm just going to ignore it.
No, this is an opportunity to promote the show. Say, I gave a response. You have to listen to Polycast.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I could do that. I'll think about that.
As well as ye olde regulars, Makalua.
Wait, you didn't st-
the what?
What the hell just happened? And yeah, I didn't really give Doug any time to insert a witty repertoire. Repertoire?
Record date?
March 25th, 2010. Never Gonna Give You Up clip by Rick Astley, courtesy RCA Records.
Civilization sound clips, copyright Take Two Interactive.
Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.